Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Geek Warning from the Escape Collective. I'm James Huang, and I'm joined today in our virtual studio by Dave Rome in Sydney, Australia. Hi, Dave.
Hello.
And we also have Ronan McLaughlin in Ireland. Hi, Ronan.
Hi, James.
So the usual crew for, I think, several weeks in a row now. It feels weird, actually.
Such consistency can only be a good thing. That's a good thing, isn't it?
It tells us you're not away at races, Ronan.
No, away next week, but none of the race, and not on Geek Warning evening, so should be here next week also.
Well, Ronan, speaking of being away, I'm kind of curious, how slow does your Ford Transit feel now?
I mean, it feels faster than I looked driving a Formula One car, but it feels slow, slower than I felt in said Formula One car.
How was there a speed limit on that Formula One car driving
experience? There wasn't, but it was like a converted RAF base, and the track was designed intentionally to sort of keep you in tech or whatever. Like it, I think the max speed you maybe get up to, there's no speed or anything, but I think it was probably about 80 miles per hour or whatever before you got into the next band. And but it was like you were there within a second of coming out of a hairpin. Oh.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Mm. Would you recommend it?
I definitely would, yeah. To be honest, other elements of the day were probably as good or more
exciting. Like seeing Johnny Long?
Like seeing Johnny Long, of course. but there was like a drift session in the morning. There was an F1000 driving session on a better track where you had more freedom just to use the car. And had you had the opportunity to use the Formula One car on that track, it would have been just unbelievable. Gotcha. But I think, as we can all sort of understand, they have a Formula One car that members of the public are allowed to drive. And not only was the track quite limiting to sort of keep members of the public from destroying the car, but also the part of the track that you drove the Formula One car on was much better surface, much smoother. You just couldn't have driven it on the other track. So,
sure.
But I mean, a bucket list thing nonetheless.
Well done.
That's cool. That's
pretty cool.
Dave, I got another tool related question for you. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to present a hypothetical situation to you. So Armageddon has come.
Uh-oh.
You are forced to become a self-sufficient nomad, and you can only carry one tool with you as you roam whatever's left of the earth. What do you bring with you?
Are there zombies?
Oh, are there zombies? Yes, but you have other things to deal with that.
Oh, okay. I don't know. Probably a Abby Crombie, because a loose cassette's really annoying. No, I'm just kidding. Geez, that's a good question. I don't know. Probably some kind of Leatherman or something actually useful.
Surely it has to be a 3D printer, and then you can just print whatever you need.
Oh, very good. Very good. Yes. Yes. There you go. That's the answer then.
Huh, okay. So you're just going to lug around a 3D printer and some filament and something to plug it into.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Generator.
All right.
You had your chance to set the rules here, James.
I did. All right. Yeah, well,
putting me on the spot about this. I'm not much of a doomsday prepper, so I don't really think about this. But anyway.
I don't exactly think about this stuff either. I do have quite a lot of food in my house. Yeah. I wouldn't exactly call myself a prepper, however. Anyway, moving
related. I've got some friends who firmly believe that if we ever had a zombie apocalypse, I'd be like one of the first people to die, which is really nice of them to say. But anyway,
is there a reason for that?
They just don't think I'd live very long. So, which is fair. Oh. Like I'm not a big guy. I'm not. Anyway,
okay,
we're going off topic now. Let's get back to bikes.
We're definitely going off the rails. All right, well, we might be approaching the end of bike racing season. Things are still pretty awfully busy on the tech front, however, and we've actually got quite a lot to talk about today. So Shimano finally announced its long anticipated road crankset recall, and we're definitely going to talk about that. SRAM is finally getting into the e-bike game. It's kind of surprising that they haven't really had something before. Pinarello's got a new favorite letter of the alphabet. Canyon's going all in with its proprietary front end for road bikes. Specialized wants people to start thinking a little differently about how we look at e-bike performance too. We've also got a little following up to do on that little Continental tire blow-off video we mentioned to you a few weeks ago, and we'll make sure we reserve a little more time today to check out what's on our minds. First up in the news is this Shimano crank recall. So technically speaking, this announcement last week was only an official recall for the United States and Canada, but Shimano said that the corrective action was occurring worldwide. We don't have official figures for exactly how many cranksets are affected worldwide, but a seemingly safe guess is somewhere around 2 or 3 million-ish. Keep in mind, this is only for Altegra and Dura-Ace cranks produced between June 2012 and June 2019. I don't think this recall came as a surprise to people who have been paying any attention to this issue for the last 10 years or so, but it's kind of still a mystery why this took so long.
I think the surprise was is that I think at this point, shops that had seen this happening over the years, we were so surprised that Shimano finally actually did a recall on it, because it's been such a known issue for so long that it kind of felt like Shimano was just always going to stay quiet on this and continue to either accept warranties in the background or say, sorry, your crank is 5-6 years old. Your warranty ended 3 or 4 years ago. We don't owe you anything. It definitely is very overdue. But I guess my big point on this is that from my experience, every shop I knew and every mechanic I've spoken to, that a reputable mechanic was already inspecting cranks on every Shimano bike of that sort of generation. They're already looking at the cranks for cracking and that type of thing during a service. Obviously, this adds awareness, and now people are actively taking their cranks into shops to have them inspected. But I think fundamentally, I think people on top of this were already aware of the safety issue and were already actively working on it.
So just to back up a little bit, I mean, we do have all the full technical information and action items and that sort of thing on the website. Mm-hmm. Head over to escapecollective.com, look up that article, and it'll tell you the date code and all the other stuff. I presented to Shimano a whole bunch of questions, of course, and most of them, they actually did answer quite a lot of them as far as like procedural stuff and some technical details, that sort of thing. But as far as some of the uglier issues and questions, they kind of expectedly passed. So one thing that I'm really curious about is like you said, like why this took so long, because this was a very known issue. But what's interesting to me is that if Shimano obviously knew that this was an issue, and if they kind of just wanted to keep things sort of quiet-ish and just keep people happy, then you would have thought that they would have just automatically approved every related warranty claim that people had for this sort of thing. But in looking at comments and messages from people, it's pretty clear that they weren't doing that. Actually are heard from quite a lot of people who said that their warranty claims were denied, which is a little troubling. And then to have this sort of thing come out basically 10 years later after the cranks were initially out on the market, I'm sure Shimano would never admit to this, but it really does feel like their hands were essentially forced based on, my guess, however many complaints were filed or how many injuries were logged. I think in the official CPSC report, it was something like 4,500 reported failures, and officially, it was only, what, like a half dozen reports of injury or something like that? But it's got to be more than that. It has to be.
Yeah, I think a figure that I saw quoted in the dealer side of this was around 1% failure rate, which means 99% are still good. But 1% is still a pretty big number when you're talking about a few million products.
Let's just say it's a million. Because, based on the official figures that Shimano provided in the CPSC report, the failure rate was somewhere around 0.6%. And let's just assume that it's the real-world figures are quite a bit more than that, so let's just say 1%. And then if you assume 2 million cranks out there, that's, what, 20,000 cranks?
Yep.
Kind of a lot.
That's a lot of cranks, yeah.
And that's being pretty conservative with the numbers.
It's a lot of cranks, but did it not feel like for a long time that it was kind of going to be more than that? Did
I think for sure
That's the bias of the internet, right? You often only hear and see the bad things, right? You look at, say, Thanks Shimano, the Instagram account, and they literally exist to post crack cranks. So you're like, wow, these are really common. But they, in theory, are posting most of them that are being seen on the internet.
Right. You know, and so, the thing is, obviously, they're only posting the broken stuff. It's not like they're posting the 99% of cranks
that
are broken.
That would be a very boring account if they did. But yeah.
It would be very, very boring. Yes. So regardless, even if the failure rate is 1%, even if the total number in the, you know, Shimano was very adamant in talking about how the total percentage of cranks that were experiencing failure was pretty low numerically. But the issue to me is that this is just a massive PR hit. It's just huge. Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm sure there were legal issues going on behind the scenes, no question, based on all the conversations that we've had with Shimano over the years about this. But just on the public side of things, it's just such a hit to their reputation, particularly for a company that it's almost like the bicycle equivalent of Toyota in a sense that, like, you know, you presumably would get Shimano stuff because it has this reputation for reliability and dependability and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And to have this thing be so public is, I just don't get it.
Well, I mean, Toyota's had its own recall issues where it was also similar,
sure.
You know,
I mean, no one's
forced
perfect.
Into it, but yeah.
Yeah.
I think the main takeaway for me with this is that if you're a company and you know, you've got a product with issues in the market, look after your customer.
Yes.
Because I think that's the hardest part with this is hearing all of the comments of people over the last 5 years that have had these cranks fail and being told that their product is past a 2 or 3 year warranty period and that they can't, you know, that Shimano won't do anything or doesn't owe them anything and that they're out of pocket for a new crankset. And then now this comes out and they're like, well, what the hell? Like, you know, I've spent $400 or $500 on a new crankset now. I threw out the cracked one that I was told was no warranty. And now you're telling me that you will replace it with no questions asked. I think that's the big hit here is that Shimano knew it was an issue and that they should have just been saying, look, your warranty's 2 years, maybe it's 3 years on Durace. Your crank is actually 5 years old. We don't owe you anything, but out of goodwill, we will replace this. And I think that is my wish for people in the industry looking at this is, yeah, if you know there's a problem, look after them.
Yeah, 100%, Dave. And I'm less concerned about Shimano's reputation here and more exactly what you just said there. But also, especially given how long this went on, like it's, as we said, it's a decade. It was a known problem throughout that. But I'm sort of more concerned about for all the cranks that have not developed an issue, Shimano were sort of telling us, well, just keep riding them. And as you were telling us, Dave, mechanics are already checking for cracks. And I just don't know how you, like for myself, my parents' bikes, both of these cranks on them, I'm taking those cranks off because neither of my parents are going to check those cranks and I am only there once a week and I'm probably not going to be taking the chain rings off every week to inspect there. Yeah. So
I would say it happens pretty slowly. I would say the failures that you see where the crank is in two pieces and the pedal is, you know, on the ground, I think that had probably been happening for quite a while and the person had been ignoring all sorts of horrible noises for quite some time. Like, you know, it starts as like a squeak and then it turns into a creak and then it turns into a really bad groan and then things start to feel loose and then the crank falls off. So it's not an immediate process. Like it's not like you go to push off at the lights and your perfectly fine crank just falls into two. That's just not how this happens. So I think for people, yeah, if you know what to look for and you know that any signs of delamination and sort of any signs of cracking or any signs of like movement around the chainring, bowing or anything, that's the first sign and that's when you go to get it replaced. But yeah, I think if you look at the crank and you take the chain rings off once and you look and it's perfect and there's no cracking around it, I would be saying you probably don't need to check it for a few months. And especially under casual use, you might never need to check it again.
The other issue for me, and again, given how long this went on for, is that the replacement now is a non-matching crankset. And should you happen to have a power meter, a third-party power meter with all of these cranks, you get a voucher towards the replacement power meter. But the last time I checked power meter prices and the voucher figures that I've seen quoted, it's not going to cover the cost of replacing your power meter. to me, that sort of asks questions also of the third-party power meter manufacturers, that for years we knew there was problems with these cranks, yet you sort of continually offered them. But, I mean, yeah.
But at the same time, I guess for those third-party crank manufacturers, or for those third-party power meter manufacturers, I mean, what are they going to do? Like, what option did they have, essentially? Because if you
and
had
the demand
Shimano,
was there for them.
Yeah, if you had Shimano officially saying that, well, actually, you didn't even have Shimano officially saying that there was no issue with it. You just had Shimano not officially saying anything about it.
Yeah.
So you still had all these cranks that are out on the market. You still had all these people with those cranks who wanted power meters. So if you are one of those power meter companies that has a crank-based power meter option, be it, you know, Stages, Four Eyes, whatever, you know, they were kind of stuck too, I think, because if you were to make the moral decision of like, well, there seems to be something wrong with these cranks, we should just not cater to them. Then at that point, you're just making the decision to go out of business.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think I've got two thoughts on that. The first is that in any other product, when you modify that product, like if a third party company gets involved and modifies that product to adapt and install their own product onto it, the warranty is void. So my point of view, it's actually pretty generous of Shimano to be saying, yes, like, you know, we're going to give you $300 for, you know, a refund on the money we never got from you because you went ahead and bought
the product. Is it generous, or is it realizing when to stop digging?
I think it's a generous PR move on their point. I think they've realized they've screwed up here, and I think they're willing to go out of pocket on a product they never actually sold. I personally think it's a nice thing for them to do. I don't think they actually have to do it. But that said, I also think there's probably responsibility now on the third party power meter companies to be like, okay, your voucher is for $300 and we're charging you $350. If you can prove that this is related to a recall and you're a pre-existing customer, will match that price, you know, so you're not out of pocket. I think that's probably a fair request at this point in time, and they'd absolutely have the margin to do that. And I think it would reflect and look really good on these power meter companies to do that as well. Assuming the price is close enough.
Yeah, I mean, but unfortunately at that point, then shifts the burden, the cost burden back to those third-party power meter manufacturers. Yeah. I actually got a press release from Four Eyes not too long after that recall went live. And it did talk about essentially prioritizing customers who were affected by that recall and trying, you know, doing whatever they could to expedite people getting replacement power meters. Doesn't say anything about a reduced cost, however, which I think is probably understandable, because in a lot of these situations, probably those companies can't afford to drop their prices that much. The other thing to consider is, from other people I've talked to in the industry, again, this is something that Shimano didn't really talk about, their cost for this recall is almost certainly, at least partially, if not completely, covered by some sort of liability insurance that they have. So who knows how much of this is actually coming out of their own pockets? It's hard to say. But if you're a third party power meter manufacturer, and then, you know, if you were to offer some sort of discount for people who were affected, you don't get to use that liability insurance. You get, like, because this wasn't really through any fault of your own.
No, sure.
Like, that's essentially going to come out of your pocket.
Yeah. I guess my point of view from that is that I see 4i, for example, they are more price competitive and closer to that coupon amount or that check amount that Shimano is giving than some other third party players. And I think what will end up happening is that, say, you're a Stages customer now and you need a new crank, you're probably more incentivized to go with a 4i if that's the closest price option. And I think it's probably a good idea for these other brands to offer something to keep their customers.
Or even just now, especially given how we're in this post-COVID lull in the bike industry in general, given what I think we are generally agreeing to be a pretty bad overall PR move by Shimano in general on this whole thing, this does seem like an opportunity for some of those third-party power meter manufacturers to even just say like, hey, if this affected you, you know, provide some proof that you filed a warranty claim, whatever, and we'll give you 10% off of a replacement or something. Like, just some sort of token thing to at least
make that's kind of what
like
I meant.
Take care of them.
Yeah. But anyway, it's
James, was one of your questions to Shimano if the recall and the replacement, if they would stand over cranks for second users, or is it for first? Is it for? Why am I struggling to ask this question?
So if the product exists, they'll replace it. You don't need any proof of purchase. You don't need to go back to the original place of purchase. If you've got a crack set of cranks in your hand, they're going to replace it.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, I would say Shimano doesn't really have the luxury of being super nitpicky as far as requirements and that sort of thing. I would have to imagine there is some legal stuff going on in the background.
My thought on this is that if there were a shop that hoards broken parts, my understanding is most of the broken cranks that like were not warrantied were just thrown in the bin. But if there was if someone had decided to hoard all these and buy them, that would be quite the valuable stockpile.
Asking for a friend, is the taxi fares that some have needed to get home from a ride ended by broken cranks covered?
I don't think so. No, I don't remember seeing any mention in the official recall notice for that, unfortunately. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it doesn't extend to new cleats for the walk home. It doesn't extend to new heel pads.
Indeed. All right. Well, as I mentioned, all that information is up live on the site. So head over to escapecollective.com for all the details. If you've got any other questions about this, feel free to leave those in a comment in that article or reach out to one of us directly. We're pretty easy to get a hold of, and we'll do our best to kind of guide you in the right direction. Anyway, moving on. So I'd have to imagine... Well, we don't even have to imagine. We know that Shimano's competitors, unfortunately, are kind of licking their chops about this whole thing to some extent. We even saw some pretty cheeky Instagram posts from the likes of like FSA and that sort of thing.
That one might have been a meme, actually, one from FSA. I didn't see it on FSA's own channels.
All right.
I think it might have been a very good meme. But SRAM did the same day announce that they'd won 5 out of the 6 Grand Tours for this year.
Right. On one group set.
Yes.
Maybe a little misleading. Anyway, but speaking of SRAM, that's actually what I'm going to talk about now, because whether or not they're actually happy about this is, the whole saying about glass houses and stones. But SRAM actually did have some pretty big news, a big product release that just happened, I think today, actually, when this goes live. They just launched their first EMTB motor system called Powertrain. Mm. This thing was actually developed with Broza. So Broza was already a player in the e-mountain bike motor space. So the specs are pretty intriguing. It's pretty powerful. It's got 90 newton meters of maximum torque, 680 watts peak power. There's just 2 assist levels instead of the usual kind of 3 or 4. SRAM is calling them range and rally, basically saying any additional settings are, they're saying they're unnecessary and confusing. There's 2 battery options. One is a 730 watt hour integrated internal battery, and there's also a 630 watt external battery. Has also a 250 watt hour range extender. You can do auto shift. You can program the thing to auto shift because this thing has to be used with SRAM's own transmission drivetrain. You can shift while coasting. Pretty neat. You can obviously shift under full power because that's essentially the big draw of transmission in general. You've got a full color top tube display that's integrated into the frame. And now you have a left-hand 2-button Axis Pod controller to go along with the right-hand one that was already out with transmission.
That one exists already.
As usual. Oh, it did?
Yeah. They were using it for what do they call their suspension that I'm blanking on?
Oh, right. Flight attendant.
So you could use it for that, but also you could use it just as a reverb controller, or you could set it up to do your shifting if you wanted like road style shifting on a mountain bike. But it's actually the left one is identical to the right. It's the same pod. It's just a different mount.
This thing is going to launch initially with 4 brands. We're looking at Transition, Propane, Nuke Proof, and Gas. I don't have any prices for any of this stuff. I'm going to assume that it's not inexpensive. But it looks pretty interesting. And having ridden some e-bikes with Broza motors before, I'm expecting that this thing is going to be pretty quiet. Mm. SRAM's first e-mountain bike drivetrain system, and pretty exciting.
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of rumors of SRAM acquiring an e-bike company last year or early this year, Amprio, and there was a lot of expectation that their their system would be based around that. So it's interesting to see them partner with Brozo on this, but also not totally surprising given Brozo's the partner of Specialized as well and has well proven itself in the market. I actually bought one last week. And so I think it's going to be a good system. I think the use of Axis and the kind of the wireless move is quite positive, because that's one thing that still annoys me about a lot of EMTBs on the market, is that you still have
so
an additional
many
wire
wires
from the handlebar, which feels unnecessary. Like my wish, because I just got a Specialized Turbo for myself, and my ideal would be to just remove the handlebar remote and just have the top tube controller and just for a cleaner cockpit. But that is not possible. You have to run the handlebar controller. And that's actually kind of a thing I don't love about this new SRAM system as well, is it's wireless now, which is great, but you actually have to run that left-hand pod. The system won't work without it. From my point of view, that's fine, but then what do you do with your dropper remote? So that left-hand pod works perfectly with a reverb dropper.
Yes. So if you are running the full SRAM wireless ecosystem, then it all integrates just fine.
Yeah. So
if not, obviously, Dave, why aren't you?
Yeah, clearly. I mean, SRAM's defense, that reverb dropper is my favorite dropper on the market. It is incredible.
Quite good.
But it is so expensive, and you could understand that if you're not spending many, many, many thousands of dollars on your e-bike, that it's not going to come with that dropper post.
Right.
I think for me, that kind of feels like a bit of a weird move on their part to design it to force you into using that wireless pod. But I also think it won't take long for aftermarket accessory companies to figure out other ways of mounting that pod elsewhere on the bike.
Correct. I think you're right there.
It looks good. Anyway.
Yeah. And either way, like I said, I certainly haven't ridden it. Haven't even seen it in person, actually. But looking forward to whenever that day comes. I'm intrigued.
Yeah. And I think, just not to stay on this for too long, but I think it's worth highlighting that Shimano has very similar features available in market already. You know, not wireless, but wired electronic shifting with DI2 XT, auto shift and all that. So, I mean, SRAM's come to market and matched what's in the market, what I guess is kind of the pinnacle of shifting in the market. And yeah, it looks good, but I wouldn't say anything here is truly looking all that revolutionary.
Yeah. Either way, like I said, looking forward to trying it out at some point, and we'll see from there. But speaking of e-bikes, we're just going to touch on this next object real quickly. So Specialized just announced its new Creo 2. Like the original version, this one was designed to run as either a road or gravel bike, or both if you have different wheels and tires sitting around. It gets a more powerful motor system, goes from 35 newton meters to 50 newton meters of torque, and 240 watts to 320 watts of power. Gets the updated FutureShock 3.0 suspension up front, up to 120 miles or almost 200K of claimed range. Clearance for tires up to 29 by 2.2, which is pretty impressive for a drop bar bike. I mean, all this stuff sounds like meaningful improvements. I do know people who have one that are quite happy with it. But the thing that stands out for me is the way Specialized is calling out in its media materials some of the competition in terms of motor efficiency, which is something I haven't really seen referenced too much before, because we hear a lot about system weight and size and power and whatnot. But in this case, Specialized is claiming that their new SL 1.2 motor is able to convert 80% of the stored battery power into drive output, as compared to, they're specifically calling out like TQ, they're saying that one's only 65% efficient, and the Fazua What Ride 50 is supposedly 72% efficient. The figures quite notably don't mention brands like Bosch and Shimano. I still find that pretty intriguing, because it maybe should or could be a new metric in comparing e-bike systems.
My initial thought is Specialized is always very clever with its marketing, and this is just another area that I guess many in the industry aren't equipped to compete with them on, or haven't done the messaging on yet. And who's going to prove them wrong at this time? I'm not saying they are wrong. I think realistically they're making this claim because they've done the testing, but it's going to take some time for people to be able to say otherwise and establish metrics around this.
I haven't seen any of this. So where does the efficiency claim come from? Is it like a reduced drag or improved
percentage of energy drawn from battery that produces power is sort of what the efficiency claim is.
So yeah, exactly how they came to that figure is not entirely clear. But anyway, like I said, I just find it intriguing that they are even just calling that out, because like I said, it's just not something that we've, it's not something that I've seen be a focus of e-bike discussions in, I guess, even recent or not so recent years. So yeah. Probably something that should be talked about. I mean, it's just kind of like with electric cars, you hear a lot about, you know, battery range and size and that sort of thing, but you don't hear a whole lot. Well, maybe you don't hear enough about efficiency. Mm. Because I would say something like, I don't know, a Tesla Model 3 is probably, I would presume, more efficient than that new GMC Hummer. That's my guess anyway. But that's something that people need to consider. It's just the same as fuel economy in an internal combustion engine car. So yeah, we might be seeing a new metric as far as comparing e-bikes. So we'll see how that goes moving forward.
Aero e-bikes, is that what I'm hearing you say, James?
Well, I mean, aerodynamic efficiency would improve power efficiency in general, wouldn't it?
The brake cables, the brake hoses on this one are thankfully external, which I find Specialized has been doing more than a lot of other companies.
Well, that's a requirement on this one because it has the future shock.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. Until they get, what was the hose gobbler, right?
Yeah. Yes. God.
But yeah, I think, it's worth noting that this is much more, in my opinion, and I guess in Specialized's opinion too, this is much more a gravel bike than is a road bike now. The Creo, when it was first released, the Creo 1 was split as both, but this one feels much more gravelly, and Specialized officially don't recommend running less than a 38 millimeter tire width on this in order to keep the bottom bracket at a reasonable height.
Yeah, which is fair, because realistically speaking, there probably aren't going to be too many people who are going to run it, who are going to run a tire that small anyway. Mm-hmm. But yeah, good word of warning there. All right, well, let's move away from e-bikes here. Ronan, what is up with this weird X on the new Pinarellos?
That must be the X stays that you're referring to on the new Dogma X and X series endurance bikes from Pinarello, which are, I mean, I've gone into this in quite a lot of detail and spent twice last week. I spent 60 minutes on conference calls with Pinarello and spent an entire day on Friday writing this up. So probably worth going across the website to get more details on it.
But for Ronan's own sanity, please go to escapecollective.com and read his story.
Effectively, what it is it's a Dogma F looking bike with the kind of geometry that I think we talked about a couple of weeks ago that we would like to see an endurance bike. So the Dogma X is slightly higher and slightly shorter in terms of stack and reach than a Dogma F, which is the out and out competition bike Pinarello were saying now, whereas the X series is more relaxed again and has quite a tall or stack and much shorter reach.
How does it compare to, like, where does it sit in this, the frame of like the BMC Road Machine and Cervelo Caledonia? Is it more upright than that?
Sorry, I can't answer that question.
Oh, okay.
As in, I don't really know off the top of my head.
I don't remember the numbers on the Road Machine off the top of my head, but looking at the Caledonia and just looking at some of the Pinarello specs, it does seem like this Dogma X is quite upright and short, relatively speaking.
I would say that's probably the X series
you were looking at. Yeah. Yes.
The Dogma X is, again, I don't recall the numbers off the top of my head. It's almost a week ago now that I was typing this up, but it's I thought it was, at the time of reading it, I thought it was sort of happy medium in terms of what I would be looking for in an endurance bike. I thought the X series would be much too tall and short for what I'd be looking for, but the Dogma X was closer. Anyway, we're kind of missing the whole point about the X stays in this thing.
Well, yeah, because that's what I wanted to ask you, because this extra bracing that that Pinarello has put on these frames, it's essentially just like another little span that goes from the almost from the top of the seat stays onto the seat tube, mm-hmm. Which I would say also makes this more of a Y than an X, first of all. But anyway, is Pinarello essentially saying that this is the only way that they can produce the blend of, I guess, lateral stiffness and vertical flex that they're looking for in a bike that doesn't have a brake bridge? Because that's what I'm taking. That's what I'm taking from this.
Well, that's where the X comes in, and that the Dogma X, so the sort of between the premium endurance bike now, it has a. Maybe I should back up a little bit in that all these bikes feature like an arced seat stay that runs all the way to the junction with the seat tube at the top tube, like a traditional bike would have done, and you're not getting any drop stays you see more recently. But Panarello say that the problem with that design, although it adds in a lot of flex that you would want in terms of compliance and that, you actually lose a lot of lateral flex, a lot of lateral stiffness, because you haven't got the bridge there where a rim brake used to occupy. And so they have filled that gap where the rim brake bridge used to be with the X bridge on the Dogma X, which is where it gets its name from. And I would agree that the additional seat stay junctions to the seat tube do make more of a Y shape. But because of this X bridge that replaces that rim brake bridge, that's where the name X comes from. The X series also gets the name X, obviously, but it doesn't get that X bridge. So they've gone entirely for the Vertigo compliance there, and they've left the X bridge out of it.
That's very confusing.
Yeah, sorry. I have a child calling me at the top of the stairs, a child that should be asleep hours ago. So I was slightly.
I'm not referring to what you said as confusing. I'm referring to Pinarello's choice of calling them a Dogma X and what is it? X series.
Yeah.
The other thing that's kind of confusing is that I don't know if everyone remember. Well, I'm sure you two remember, but for everyone listening. I think it was the 21 tour when Stephen Croswick finished the stage of the tour with a seat stay that was basically completely missing off of his Cervelo. And at the time, not too long after that, we had a conversation with Scott Roy from Cervelo. And at least from Cervelo's point of view and his point of view as a frame engineer, he kind of made it pretty clear that seat stays don't really do much of anything anyway, at least in his opinion. So it's just intriguing that you have such divergent viewpoints, at least publicly, from two companies that are pretty big.
Not sure actually on that. And my understanding of that is that yes, seat stays don't actually do all that much when you can beef up your bottom bracket and your chain stays to maintain the lateral stiffness that you require in a performance bike. What Panarello didn't really seem to want to do was and beef up the bottom bracket area any further. But they did want to add in this Vertigo compliance. Vibration absorption was a big one they talked about, and they've said that to be fair to them, they did say that the number one thing you do if you want to include extra comfort is bigger tires. So they did that, and then by elongating the chain stays and by going for the arced seat stays to improve compliance even further, they introduced so much lateral flex that they then needed to stiffen up the frame with the X bridge
with more triangles.
Yeah, and to me,
comfort-inducing triangles.
Well, to me, the stiffness element of that claim adds up in that if you look at this X bridge, the triangulated shapes within it, those are exactly the type of shapes you would expect to see introduced in an area where you're trying to improve stiffness, and they're clearly, you know, working on some shear forces between the chainstays, and they're triangulating those and stiffening up the whole area. The part of where the claim doesn't land with me, and the reason I required a second call with Panarello and still doesn't land with me, is the claim that the additional two junctions to the seat tube help absorb more vibrations. And to me, that whole area just looks like it adds more stiffness. I can't really see how that adds any comfort and compliance.
James, you'll get this, but this is reminding me of old GT triple triangle marketing.
I mean, I certainly remember GT Triple Triangle, but I don't remember what they were saying as far as the marketing goes.
I might be remembering this wrongly, and maybe I'm confusing it with another brand that did something similar. But yeah, there were claims that it was dissipating forces into the top tube and not directly into the C tube, and that you know, like spreading the forces around or the loads, you know. So yeah, smoother ride, which.
Either way, the question, I guess the real question is, I know that you didn't have a chance to ride this bike at length necessarily.
I haven't ridden the bike at all.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so then there's no point in me asking you this question, because what I'm wondering is if this thing actually works anyway. And I guess the answer to that is we don't know yet.
Mm, haven't ridden this bike at all. Yeah, interested to get a feel for it though.
All right. Well, as Ronan mentioned, he does have a very detailed write-up up on escapecollective.com. So head over there to check it out. And then in the meantime, we're going to continue working to see if we can get a test sample here to find out if this thing actually works.
And I as well will go back and read it so I can get an understanding of the difference between a Dogma X and a X series without the Dogma.
F, competition bike. X, endurance bike.
Still confused. All right.
All right. Next up, Canyon just announced a mid-cycle refresh of their in-flight cyclocross bike. Frame itself is unchanged as far as I can tell, but the main difference is the front end. So a new fork, a new cockpit, and they have added their CP0018 aero cockpit to this bike, the same one that is used on the Endurace and Aero and Ultimate. And basically what you get now is fully hidden cabling. I can kind of understand why that would be kind of appealing from a cross perspective, just because of all the mud and like not wanting to get things tangled up and like sort of like an easier to clean perspective sort of. But I am maybe not super excited about the fact that as much as I like how that CP0018 feels in my hands and as nice as it kind of looks, it's also among the most difficult systems to service. It also offers pretty limited adjustability, which seems to me to be things that maybe you wouldn't want to introduce into a cross bike, especially the serviceability thing.
Yep. And the ability to change like bar tilt, for example, which is very common to do from rider to rider in cross.
I'm scratching my head on this one a little bit. I can certainly see why. I guess I can't recall an instance where a brand has so widely spread one component concept across multiple ranges. So again, Canyon's using this on the Aeroad, Ultimate, Endurace, and now InFlight. And as far as I can tell, these are the exact same cockpits. Like one aspect of this thing is it has a three-piece design with removable ends. You do get adjustable width, which is kind of neat. That's a nice little feature. But one of the things that Canyon had touted at the introduction of this thing however many years ago was that they would be able to offer different drop shapes. And to date, we have not seen that as far as I'm aware. And it seems like this would be such a prime opportunity to do that.
In theory, I love the idea of brands reusing components because it means future availability of those components once the brand is discontinued. I mean, the pressure for them to keep supply of those parts is just going to be that much greater, and the ability to find those parts will be that much greater. So generally speaking, I love when brands have, like, say, a D-shaped seat post and they keep the same shape across multiple generations. And in theory, this is what is happening there, and I should be more positive about it. But as you say, James, this is one of the harder systems to service. And I had friends waiting for the new, say, Canyon Endurace to come out and to see what that was like. And I've actively advised them not to get that based purely on how hard this cockpit is to service. It kind of pains me that Canyon has decided that this is the thing that they're going to put on every bike that they have, because it's just, again, on paper and in theory, it's a really neat design, but in practice, when it comes to replacing a headset bearing, or if you happen to, say, crash the bike and you need to replace part of the handlebar, it's just
which not happens a lot in cross, I should say.
Yes, yeah, it's just both replacing headset bearings and crashing happens a lot in cross. It's just not a nice system to work with. So yeah, I don't know. Those are my thoughts on it. I'm sorry, Canyon. Generally speaking, love what you do, but I'm looking forward to the generations of bike when you don't use the soundbar.
Maybe the CP019?
Maybe. Perhaps.
Perhaps. Anyway.
All that aside, I think they could make this a lot better if there was at least different stem length options available.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that you still can't choose a stem length and at the time when you order the bike is still kind of blows my mind a little bit. Canyon does like to say that The stock length does fit the majority of people who are ordering whatever frame size there is, but if you are not in the majority, then sorry.
Do you not pay the same price as the majority then if you're not?
Anyway.
I'm a little bit sore about the subject at the moment because I was replacing internally rooted brake hoses on a bike recently and got halfway through the job and noticed that I hadn't been sent the right headset cap. So I put it all back together and so I ended up with a bit of a sort of internal, sort of external setup. It would have worked fine, but it just didn't look all that good. And when I then went to throw out the empty box, I realized I had been sent the headset cap. And so now I have to do it all again. And I had actually timed the job the first time and it was like 90 minutes. And that was being pretty efficient.
Yeah, that's actually pretty quick. So,
Eek. Anyway, Dave, as you mentioned, sorry, Canyon. Don't mean to rain on your parade of this lovely mid-cycle refresh of your in-flight, but not a move that I am super excited about. Anyway.
Which is a shame because there's really not many brands offering dedicated cyclocross bikes. So in theory, they'd have a pretty, you know, a small market, but they'd have a good sized chunk of that small market to cater to. Anyway.
So those team mechanics for the cross bikes, sorry. anyway, moving on. Back in early August, we talked about a YouTube video that someone had made that was basically saying Continental's tubeless road tires weren't safe because they blew off the rim at unreasonably low inflation pressures. Caused quite a bit of, stirred up quite a bit there, a lot of discussion around that. Lots of people suddenly thinking that Conti tires weren't safe. Well, that person has just published a follow-up video, and the results are about what we expected, I should say. Like, looking back, I think we were pretty much dead on. So as it turns out, Continental was obviously quite interested in what was going on here, and they contacted the person who made the video and requested the tire and then ended up requesting the wheel also to do a little bit more of an in-depth analysis, just if nothing else, just to find out what was going on here, because if there was an issue with their tire, they wanted to know about it. But according to Continental's analysis, their tire is fine. Actually, turns out that they took that same tire and mounted it on a rim that was in the right spec and dimensions and everything and held up just fine. However, it was actually the extra light carbon rim that was at fault here because it was made without following established ISO or ETRTO dimensional guidelines for hookless tubeless rims. So basically, the rim diameter was too small and the sidewalls are too low.
That's how they save weight. Make the wheel diameter smaller. It saves weight.
Yeah. And there was even a graphic on the side of the rim saying that the maximum inflation pressure was much higher than what it should have been. So this is not a case where Continental is just tossing Extra Light under the bus. Apparently, this customer also contacted Extra Light to find out what the heck was going on and what they could do. And Extra Light basically admitted that they decided on their own that because they thought that tubeless road tires at the time or whenever this rim was made, because they thought that tubeless road tires were kind of unreasonably hard to install, they sort of just decided to make the rim smaller to make it easier to install those tires. But the brand actually had the gall to suggest to this user that they just add more roll or add more wraps of tape to increase the rim diameter, which of course would also make the sidewall even shorter than it is now. Less than ideal situation, as our friend Raul Lucier would like to say. To me, the takeaway from this is that hookless still is not my favorite setup for the road. I will say that. However, if the dimensional tolerances are properly followed, then stuff like this shouldn't happen. And I think this is the sort of thing where you have a case where someone is being pretty irresponsible with their product and releasing product that they apparently knew is not in accordance with the dimensional guidelines. And flat out, they're putting people at risk, I think.
I think I feel quite justified now in my Partington review from last week, kind of saying that 1,000-gram steel spoke disc brake wheels scare me. And that's the one reason why I wouldn't purchase an extra light wheel versus something like a Partington. Feeling quite justified in that, having heard and seen all this now.
Well, that said, had Extra Light made this rim just a little bit bigger and just a little bit taller in the sidewalls, then yes, the rim would have been a little bit heavier, but presumably this tire maybe wouldn't have blown off.
Yeah, I still think that when you get wheels this light with steel spokes, you still there's still issues and questions around the hoop stiffness of the wheel. So how much it compresses under the pressure of the tire, and how much that changes the diameter of everything, like how much spoke tension loss you have. And that's something that Partington, I know, put a lot of effort into to figuring out and to retaining that stiffness and making everything stiff enough that you don't get that spoke tension drop. And I don't think it's that easy of an engineering solution. And I strongly question whether the likes of Extra Light would put the research and development into that aspect of it, that there is no shrinkage of the rim. So yeah, I still stand by my statement that when we're talking about really, really lightweight disc brake wheels, that you need to be thinking about things like that, which are not necessarily something the brand's ever going to talk about. But yeah, like how the wheel is going to respond to being put under a significant pressure, and whether you see spoke tension drop. And if you see spoke tension drop, then that is a sign that things are shrinking, and that's probably going to affect your tire fitment as well. So
the other big revelation from the follow-up video that nobody has touched on, We now know why he exploded tire sealant all over his kitchen. Did you see how well he keeps his garden? I wouldn't be having sealant on that garden, no way.
Was his garden cleaner than the kitchen?
The kitchen was pretty clean.
The kitchen was pristine as well. I mean, both of them were just, yeah, but I just. It was a joke, Dave.
Oh. Oh,
okay. All right. Well, our last bit of news today actually has nothing to do with bike product at all. Not specifically anyway, but rather a new tech podcast from Escape Collective. Ronan, take it away. This is your baby here. What are we talking about here?
We literally just finished up recording one of the first episodes earlier today. This is Performance Process, the podcast that myself and Kaylee Fretz are going to be doing, kind of speaking to experts in performance and unpacking some of the different processes that go into some of the best performances that you hear or see around the world. So whether you're interested in going faster yourself or you're just interested in understanding how the pros are going faster and faster each year, we're going to try and break down as much of that as we can.
So this is a mountain bike focused podcast?
It is not.
Okay.
It's all elements of performance. It'll be transferable, but I certainly will not be leading the mountain bike charge on it.
Okay. All right.
So how frequently are you going to be putting episodes out?
You should expect to hear from us every second week, every other week, fortnightly, bi-weekly, however you describe every other week around the world.
And where are people going to be able to find this thing, Ronan?
It's for members only, actually, James.
What?
So you have to be an Escape Collective member to hear these podcasts. But no doubt, the Escape members can tell non-members how good this is and spread the word that way. If you want to listen, you'll have to go to escapecollective.com/join if you're not already a member.
Yeah. If you are a member, how do you get access to this?
We will be sharing an RSS feed that you literally just click a link and then you don't really have to think about it again. It will automatically populate into your chosen podcast library app or whatever. So it's simple from then on.
All right, we'll run in this first.
Can we have a little tease of what episode you might have recorded?
Just going to ask the same thing.
Yeah, well, the podcast we recorded today may or may not be the first go live. But I will tell you that within the first week, we have either the process of winning all three Grand Tours in one season or the process of breaking 10-hour records will be the topics up for discussion.
Well, any idea when we are going to publish this
October
first episode?
October 5th will be the first. So not long to go. There's a pilot episode, I think, dropping round about right now as we record this. So yesterday as you're listening.
Intriguing. All right. Well, I'm excited to get this thing off the ground. I think hopefully people are excited to listen to it. Yeah, I think it'll be pretty cool. It'll certainly give you a venue to get even geekier.
Yeah, which I know that you want to also do. Just a yes, there will be geeking out on it, but there's it's also just a way of sort of, you know me, I'm always going to be focused on my next performance or whatever, or training towards something that I'm working towards. And quite often, thanks to the luxury position I have within this job, I get to speak to a lot of very, very intelligent people who know how to make the most of whatever power you have. And rather than keeping those conversations to myself or limiting them to whatever I can fit into an article, we're literally just going to be having those conversations with a mic recording and then publishing them. So they'll be there for the benefit of all our members.
Cool. Well, it sounds exciting, Ronan. I'm looking forward to it. Hopefully everyone listening to this is as well. First episodes are going to be dropping pretty soon. So yeah, pay attention. All right. Well, let's, like I said, we're wrapping up the news section here. Let's find out what's on everyone's mind this week. Dave, you want to start first here?
Yeah, I kind of teased it earlier in the episode, but I bought an e-bike and I'm an e-mountain biker now. So yeah, I've got flat pedals on it, and I'm wearing my big trail helmet. I'm going to start wearing knee pads on every ride.
You've got a Toyota Tacoma now.
I still need to get that. I actually need to get a suitable bike rack for my e-mountain bike. But yeah, I'm one of them. I'm joining them, and it's what a hoot. So for me, I'd been wanting one for a couple of years now. So being in Sydney, I'm in the northern beaches of Sydney, and we have a lot of great mountain bike trails around here, but all of them are pretty technical descents with a lot of elevation loss. And then you have very steep climbs back out. So you don't get a lot of descending for the amount of climbing you do. And that, combined with the highly technical and very rocky terrain, you're kind of encouraged to ride like a long travel enduro bike, but then the climbs suck. So I've always had like a, you know, downcountry sort of short travel trail bike, but then I don't feel confident on any of the descents. So for me, I think, yeah, an e-mountain bike makes perfect sense, and it explains why we see so many of them around here, that you have the suspension travel to get you down the hill, and then you have a motor to get all that suspension travel back up the hill. I'm hoping that I descend more and get my confidence on rocks back to where it once was, and it's exciting.
That's funny that you mentioned that you've been thinking about that for the last couple of years and for that type of trail, because there is a trail network that's pretty close to me. That's one of the most popular, or I guess one of the ones that I frequent most often. And it's pretty similar terrain, actually. Lots of very steep and technical descents, pretty heinous climbs to get to those descents. And I have actually considered several times over the last few years whether or not it's maybe time to finally bite that bullet and pick up an e-mountain bike. And I dare say that's probably going to happen sooner than later for me. We'll see. There's an awful lot of interesting entrants into that market. So I think there's going to be an e-mountain bike in my future at some point. And it's interesting because a lot of people who are kind of die hard against e-mountain bikes, they say that it's just cheating and you're lazy and whatever. I would actually almost argue the opposite, because all of my friends, anyway, that I know who have both regular and powered mountain bikes, they complement each other seemingly quite well, because the people who do ride e-mountain bikes, they have become noticeably better and more skilled riders because they are able to session things more and more often. And that is certainly something that I picked up on in the last few years. So, I might be joining you sometime soon.
Ooh. Yes, welcome. I will say that as a tech editor, I took so long to buy one. I remember going to a demo session to ride the very first Turbo Levo when Specialized first entered the mountain bike space. So, I mean, I'm not new to this space. I'm definitely not an expert in the space, but I'm not new to it. And I've owned e-bikes before. And what took me so long to get an e-mountain bike is that, I mean, one, they're incredibly expensive during COVID, but also, the technology moves so fast. And James, you know, I see, you know, we get a little bit of advance notice or hear rumors of what's coming, and it's hard to know when to jump in because you're just seeing this rapid advancement in this industry. You're like, oh, if I just wait another 6 months, then the motors will be 10% more powerful and 10% lighter. And that was kind of the hesitation, is I was like, you know, watching the skipping rope going around and couldn't figure out when to jump in. And I finally bit the bullet. And obviously, there's always going to be new things just around the corner. But eventually, you just have to go, you know, that bike does what I need and it has everything I want on it. And so be it if it's out of date in 6 months' time. So, yeah. So that's why I ended up with the Turbo Levo, is that on paper, it's, I mean, I got friends that I very much trust, some in media, some not, that have that bike, and they rave about it and they say it's the best one they've ridden. And I like that the cable routing wasn't through the headset, which quite a few e-bikes do. And I like the motor system on it. But yeah, it also, you know, it sort of just felt like it had a high amount of power compared to other systems on the market and a good amount of refinement. So that's how I ended up on a Turbo Levo.
Well, cool. Let's, like I said, I'm pretty sure this is not going to be the first time that we talk about your dive into the e-mountain bike space. So it should be fun. Speaking of mountain bikes, someone sent me, well, I shouldn't say that they sent me, but I think it was posted on the Escape Collective member-only Discord channel. A very valid question, actually, talking about, or I guess asking, whether it makes sense for Schrader valves to be back in play for mountain bikes. And honestly, I don't see why that wouldn't be the case necessarily, because it makes an awful lot of sense. I mean, Presto valves were, they came about because the rims were getting narrower and narrower and you didn't want to have that big of a hole in the rim. But nowadays, that's not really an issue because mountain bike rims in particular have gotten awfully wide.
Yeah.
And especially Android with rims. Everything... Yeah, and especially with everything running tubeless, the larger body diameter on a Schrader valve seems like it'd be perfect, actually. It'd be far less likely to clog, especially with like the less intricate internals of that thing. I don't see any functional reason why that shouldn't be the case. Do you?
No, not at all. I feel like this is a topic that comes up every year or two, and there's an opinion piece written by some editor somewhere at a mountain bike site that's like, why isn't this already a thing? And then a few brands kind of offer it, and then it disappears again just due to cycling being a traditional based, you know.
Yep.
we've always done things. There's in my mind, there's no legitimate reason that we shouldn't be doing this. There seems to be a lot of people trying to recreate and reinvent the Presto valve, like the reserve Fillmore valve comes to mind, which is, you know, a good product in many ways, but in my mind, the Schrader valve would achieve much the same thing at a much lower cost.
I mean, in Ronan's thinking to himself right now, oh, but Schrader valve stems would be so much less aero.
It's almost like you read my mind.
but then you get the, what's the company that has the removable valve?
Newman.
Yeah. Mm, then you just get
which does actually use a Schrader valve, doesn't it?
Yeah. Oh, I think so.
If I remember correctly. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, Ronan, I don't see any reason not to.
Yeah. Well, I guess we'll just continue to see what happens there. If anything, I'm guessing probably nothing. Cause like you said, Dave, this is something that pops up pretty frequently. Mm. And it never seems to lead to anything, but stranger things have happened.
The other misconception around Presto and Schrader is that the common misconception is related to pressure, is that there's a lot of people that believe Presto handles high pressure better, but that's just not the case because they use Schrader valves on air suspension, which, so your 300, 350 PSI rear shock has a Schrader valve. So pressure is not an issue.
Could we develop a valve of either type that when used on a hookless rim and exceeds 70 PSI, just instantly fails? Yes. Or something? Or
yeah, there are pressure release valves already in the market. I vaguely think it's a different purpose. It's to relieve any accidental pressure in the sidewall of the rim, but I think like Karima has something like that in play.
Envy has like a pressure release valve, yeah, nut sort of thing.
Yeah.
But nothing quite like what you're talking about, Ronan. It's an interesting idea, however. It's intriguing. Speaking of aero, Ronan, you've got some thoughts on fairings, I believe, don't you?
I mean, anybody who listens to the Placeholder podcast this week will have heard 20 minutes of me discussing. I don't like to call them fairings, James. I like to call them onboard aero structures. on-body aero structures.
They're fairings.
Or the other one I came up with was WAMI bars, which stands for wake altering. Oh, I can't remember now, but anyway. I have another, as we already discussed, I have another podcast now where I maybe get to divulge the aero stuff on my mind. So I'll keep this one short, but basically the thing on my mind this week is the growing trends within the competitive space in terms of either time trialing with your head down or adding a camelback down the front of your skin suit or whatever it might be, narrower bars, skin suits. Basically, the idea that there is a slam dunk aero gain out there that will be faster for everybody. And more often than not, there is no such thing as a slam dunk aero gain. It could be slower for one person, faster for another. It might be no different for the next person. And
except for head socks. Head socks are universally considered faster. Sorry.
Is faster the word you were looking for there? So as I spoke to more and more people this week on about these fairings that have been causing quite the debate in the UK time trialing scene, the recurring theme that has been coming up and the recurring discussion with these experts in the field is before you spend anything or make any assumptions in terms of aero, if at all possible, try to test it in some way, shape or form because, yeah, it's just so rider dependent. I don't know if that was a PSA or on my mind or whatever, but if we're sticking to e-bikes, the other thing on my mind at the moment that I'm not ready to get into yet is electric cargo bikes. I'm doing a lot of looking into those at the moment.
Oh, that should be a fun discussion. But I was just going to say that we're pretty much out of time anyway, so we can just say that your aero discussion just now was both an on your mind and a PSA, and we can just call it good there.
Okay.
We are actually pretty much out of time here, so we're just going to go ahead and wrap this one up. I know we have already mentioned earlier about our membership for Escape Collective, but this seems like a perfect time to remind you anyway that if you are not already a member of the Escape Collective, now's a good time to join. You can head over to escapecollective.com/join because membership is how we fund everything that we do here. And if no one pays for what we're doing, then we can't do this anymore, which would make us very sad.
Could you imagine an hour-long podcast with our voices not in it? I mean, that would be much worse. So.
I mean, this podcast exists because of our members, but new podcasts soon, such as the one Ron was talking about, The Process, are about to exist just for our members and only for our members. I think I teased this last week, and again, we'll tell you more soon, but we're going to have more Geek Warning style episodes as well, just for members. This podcast that you're listening to now isn't going to go anywhere. It'll remain open, but there's more to come for those that support us.
We're going to continue to guilt trip you, though. So be aware.
Very much so.
So one last request before we sign off. As I mentioned in last week's show, it is actually very helpful for us if people leave more ratings and reviews on iTunes because it helps more people find the show. So thank you to everyone who left those ratings and reviews in the last couple weeks. It's been very helpful. If you have not already done so, please head over to iTunes and leave us a rating and review for Geek Warning. And as we said before, you can say whatever you want in the comments, but 5 stars only, please. Help us out. Anyway, that'll do it for this week's episode of Geek Warning. Thanks again for listening as always, and we'll see you next week.
Cheers.